Japan's is the world's third largest economy, but last week's devastating earthquake and tsunami, plus the unfolding nuclear crisis, have caused much of that economy in parts of the country to come to a screeching halt. We're joined now by Greg Ip of The Economist magazine. He's also the author of The Little Book of Economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World, and by David Weinstein, Associate Director of Research at the Center of Japanese Economy and Business, part of the Columbia Business School. Welcome to our show.
Hello.
Thank you.
The World Bank put the economic damage at as much as $235 billion, or around 4% of Japan's gross domestic product. Greg, how does that incredible number compare with some of the other disasters throughout history?
It's definitely on the high side and certainly more expensive than the Kobe earthquake, which is the closest analog we have to what's just happened to Japan. That earthquake did not bring along the damage of the tidal wave and nuclear meltdown that this one has. But it should be kept in context. Japan's economy is large enough to absorb that kind of damage, and it doesn't all have to be replaced at once. It's a little bit like, you know, some of your own wealth disappearing from a bad day in the stock market, but your monthly income is still the same. So Japan, their economy in the first half of the year will probably take a significant hit to growth, but they'll get some of that back in the second half of the year as some of these factories that have had to idle production redouble their output and as government finance reconstruction efforts start to take hold.
Well, the World Bank estimates that Japan will spend up to 5 years rebuilding from the disaster. And David, as Greg suggests, that rebuilding is likely to pump more money into the economy and boost it. But can you talk a bit about what happened after the 1995 Kobe earthquake? How much of an impact did that have on the Japanese economy? Hasn't it suffered ever since, or was that unrelated?
So one wants to separate the impact of broad macro shocks from the impacts of earthquakes and natural disasters. When we look at the Kobe earthquake, what we see is that there was a lot of destruction in that earthquake. About 6,400 people lost their lives. A quarter of a million homes were either destroyed or partially destroyed. Millions of people lost electricity, et cetera. But when one looks at the economic impact of that, it's actually hard to see a big impact in the year or even in the quarter in which the earthquake occurred. Industrial production fell by about 3% in January when the earthquake hit, but bounced back 2% the following month and up another 1% the month afterwards. And the economy grew at about 1.9% that year. So while these catastrophic events have devastating impacts on the individuals who are affected by this, the impact that they have on economic growth tends to be much more muted.
Well, I wonder about insurance. I can't imagine that all $235 billion. That's projected as the damage here, and it may go higher, obviously, because of the nuclear crisis at Fukushima is far from resolved. I can't imagine all of that would be covered by insurance. Did the insurance industry help in the 1995 recovery?
So, actually, it depends. Some people were able to have earthquake insurance, and others were not able to have earthquake insurance. So obviously, there are a lot of uncertainties in the current earthquake. Any cost estimate is really nothing more than educated guesswork at this point. That said, it's pretty clear that Japan has a glut of savings, and one of the things that's going to happen as Japan emerges from this crisis is that there's going to be a very big rebuilding effort that will come both from the government as well as from households. And so that's likely to be paradoxically somewhat stimulative and reduce some of the downturn in economic activity.
But, Greg, George Mellowin of the Wall Street Journal quoted the 19th century economist Frederick Bastiat, who taught the fallacy of the broken window and that destruction is not profitable, meaning that the growth that comes from reconstruction just replaces over time what was lost. Do you think there is a potential for long-term economic gain for Japan from all of this?
In the short run, no. I mean, George's point is absolutely accurate. It's, if your house is destroyed by a hurricane, then the rebuilding of that house is going to put a lot of people to work. But at the end of the process, you're not any wealthier. All you got back was something that was destroyed in the first place. So that goes back to the point that in the short run, a country is less wealthier, but the level of economic activity in any given month or quarter can still pick up as this reconstruction goes to work. Will it make the country wealthier in the long run? There's a couple of conflicting forces here. You could make the case that one of the problems that Japan's economy has been suffering from in the last few decades is insufficiently aggressive efforts by both the government and its central bank to stimulate spending by the Japanese people and to overcome this phenomenon of deflation, which is when prices are keep falling year in and year out. The Bank of Japan has already pursued a very aggressive response to this disaster, pumping money into the banks, expanding its unconventional monetary policies such as purchasing government and corporate bonds. It's tried to keep the yen from rising too fast, which would damage the export part of the sector of the economy. And if the finance ministry were to join in with very vigorous stimulus-type efforts, it's possible that could put a lot of Japanese people back to work who've been without work for a very long time. But that's a very big question mark. It's not at all guaranteed that that kind of rebuilding program could be pulled off properly.
But you're saying that this is an opportunity to abandon the institutions that have led to Japan's economic stagnation. It's just up to the Japanese to actually do that. But
yeah. But
didn't they learn any lessons from what happened after World War II? Japan not only rebuilt, it was able to rebuild from scratch and actually move ahead of some of the older economies. Like they developed a better steel industry than the United States had.
Yeah, but the Japan of today is very different from the Japan of the 1950s. First of all, the Japan of the 1950s was still technologically significantly behind the United States and had enormous opportunities to grow quickly simply by adapting the best of Western technology that it could find in the United States and Europe and other places. That's one of the reasons why it grew so quickly. The other important difference was that at the time it was a relatively young country with a still growing population. One of the biggest problems that's been afflicting Japan for the last 15 to 20 years has been negative population growth, with the working age population shrinking year after year. And this is an interesting question as to whether the disaster will tend to end or aggravate those problems. Will the sort of trauma of the disaster further create a psychological burden on Japanese that makes the population problem even worse? Or could it have the opposite effect and be used as an opportunity for rebirth?
Daniel Gross, the economic editor of Yahoo Finance, wrote in his column this morning that the challenge is to replace the damaged stuff not only with something better, but with something that has the potential to be a platform for other growth. Isn't that the sort of thing Barack Obama said with his stimulus program? It hasn't worked very well here. Most governments around the world are focusing on debt reduction. Does Japan have no choice in the matter?
Well, to a certain extent, it has no choice. I mean, there is extensive damage to vital infrastructure that simply has to be repaired. The problem it faces, which every government, including Barack Obama's, faces when it has these ambitions to use these opportunities to rebuild and build a stronger economy, is that it's not always obvious where you need to put the money to get the greatest effect. Japan, in fact, has been a sadly object example in wasted money on infrastructure, where they have, you know, paved and repaved highways to remote and virtually empty parts of the country, where it seems every town has its own airport, whether or not it's actually used. And so it's not obvious that it knows exactly how to do a better job this time around.
What about aid money, David? Is Japan going to see a lot of help from countries that are feeling rather strapped themselves?
I don't think that aid is going to be the principal source of money coming in. That wasn't the case in the Kobe earthquake. While obviously it's an important way in which countries show their support for Japan's citizens, it's largely going to be an effort by the Japanese government and by the Japanese people to rebuild the economy. And I think that what we'll see initially is probably close to 10 billion yen being spent on reconstruction and other types of activities. And this is going to put some fiscal strain on the Japanese government. But most of it is going to be directed towards building probably quite similar types of roads and housing stock that we've seen before.
But what about looking into alternative energy research? Japan, of course, has no oil of its own, so that's why it has adopted the nuclear approach. But do you think that windmills and solar panels and the like will become the wave of the future in Japan?
So I think what this crisis more broadly has taught all of us are the costs of our energy dependence. Japan is already a major technological leader in green technologies. But what we're seeing here is that all of the, at least conventional, energy technologies are very expensive. We see with thermal power that there are problems such as we saw in the Gulf, plus the pollution that arises from that. Nuclear, as the most recent crisis makes abundantly clear, has its own set of problems. To an economist, there's a simple reason for why this is such a problem, and that is that energy is underpriced. We price energy according to the cost of extracting it and according to the cost of building nuclear power plants, but we don't factor in these environmental costs and other costs into the pricing of energy. If energy were priced properly, and if this can move us towards a system in which the cost of energy rises, then that will naturally give rise to other companies that will start to develop alternative technologies.
My guests are David Weinstein, Associate Director of Research at the Center of Japanese Economy and Business, part of the Columbia Business School, and Greg Ip of The Economist and author of the little book of economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World. Well, we have other issues here. Japan is an aging society with an aversion to bringing in foreigners as workers. Won't both of those factors put downward pressure on a Japanese recovery?
Well, I think you want to separate some of the very long-term factors affecting Japan's economy and the short-term impact of the earthquake. Surely the declining labor force due to the low birth rate in Japan holds down Japanese growth rates. But that suggests that what we should look at is not GDP growth rate, which also includes growth due to a growing population, but really focus on GDP per capita, which is how much output is produced by each individual worker. And what we see when we look at that is that Japan actually has not been doing that badly over the last 10 years in terms of per capita growth. And indeed, a lot of the reason why U.S. aggregate growth rates look much higher is simply because our population is growing much more rapidly than the Japanese population. But if you look at per capita growth in the U.S., it's down around 1.5% per year, not that much higher than what we've been seeing in Japan.
Greg, one party dominated Japanese politics for most of the post-war period, only voted out of office recently. The new government has been suffering a series of setbacks in recent months, even before this happened. And last week, the New York Times wrote about Japan's leadership. Never has post-war Japan needed strong, assertive leadership more, and never has its weak, rudderless system of governing been so clearly exposed. Japan's leaders need skills they are not trained to have, rallying the public, improvising solutions, and cooperating with powerful bureaucracies. And that would apply to both major parties, wouldn't it?
Yes, probably. I mean, the Japanese system has political system has suffered from a general lack of transparency and accountability for some time. And as you point out, the current government, led by Naoto Kan, was under a lot of pressure even before this crisis had struck. His very competent foreign minister had been forced to resign over a funding scandal. And the opposition, the Liberal Democratic Party, which, as you say, used to run Japan, now only controls the upper house, but was using that control threatening to block funding for the government's operations over a dispute over taxes and the current government's
budget. That sounds familiar.
It does indeed, doesn't it? Although in the United States we're used to this, and so we've worked with this kind of conflict. The checks and balances are in some sense built into the system, and it's not clear that Japanese governments have learned to deal with those checks and balances, given the long history they spent as essentially a one-party state. Now, there are some encouraging signs. For example, the LDP and the DPJ put aside most of the differences and you haven't seen so much of that inter-party squabbling since the disaster struck. And the government is also suffering problems that are not related to the politics at all, but more related to the lack of transparency and candor from the electric power company that operates the nuclear power plant there. So some of these problems are not of its own design. In fact, it brings to mind the problems that Barack Obama's administration faced with the BP oil spill, where it seemed to be rudderless and helpless in the early weeks of the disaster, and it eventually blamed it on the lack of good information it was getting from BP. I suspect that this image of fumbling and lack of competence that seems to be coming out of Japan right now will fade in coming weeks. We are already seeing the nuclear disaster at the Fukushima plant being brought under control. And as we've seen after previous disasters, the Japanese do, once they get going, they are extremely effective and efficient at bringing these things under control. But I don't think there's any question that this represents a big setback to the current government's credibility and will make it more difficult rather than easier to overcome some of the structural conflicts that are working in that system.
I throw this out to both of you. What impact is this going to have on global supply chains? Production at many of Japan's factories have been stopped. And since so many of them are high-tech uses like semiconductors, will that have an effect on the rest of the world?
I think so, especially in the short term. One of the problems that affects global supply chains is that when you're looking at production of frequencies of, you know, 1 week or a month, if a part doesn't arrive, if you're making a car and you don't have hubcaps, then you simply cannot produce. But what we also see is that as time passes, companies can bring online other suppliers of those parts. And so while we're seeing a lot of impact on we're seeing quite large impacts on producers over the course of the last week and continuing on to the next week or so, I think that once we move into the April-May timeframe, a lot of that is going to dissipate.
Well, this could have a positive effect on Detroit, couldn't it, because of the impact on Japanese markets? Although, Greg, since we're talking about a global economy, I'm assuming that the Detroit manufacturers depend on Japan for an awful lot of parts, even though they're supposedly American-made cars.
Well, that's exactly right. In fact, General Motors has already announced plant shutdowns in places as far afield as Korea, Louisiana, and Spain, precisely for this reason, because they depend on parts from Japanese-based suppliers. I do not think that these disruptions will be long-lasting and produce a permanent change in the outlook for the automobile industry. And set against, you know, whatever opportunities the American companies have to pick up some temporary sales, there's the overall negative that this disaster represents to the global economic outlook, both in terms of lost demand from Japan, the fact that it comes at the very time we're dealing with all this uncertainty from the Middle East and upward pressure on oil prices. And having been through a couple of crises just in the last few years, the world economy really doesn't need, you know, a couple more blows to its confidence. I do believe the world economy and the U.S. economy will shake this off in due course. But in the short term, it's going to have more of a negative than a positive impact. I don't think there's much question about that.
Just one more thing. Japan has been notorious about keeping its food its own and not importing very much. Even if you have the exact same rice, the Japanese will tell you that the stuff that was grown in Japan tastes better. Do you think that fears of contamination might open that market a little bit?
Well, it certainly is going to strengthen arguments for people to open up the Japanese market, right? The standard argument that protectionists have made in Japan is that we need protection in order to have food security. And this crisis seems to be flipping that argument on its head. Japan is already inching towards liberalizing its agricultural market. The prime minister, has been pushing towards a series of free trade agreements with a variety of countries, including the United States. And this may strengthen some of his arguments.
Thank you both so much for talking with us today. We've been talking about the Japanese economy and its impact on the world economy with David Weinstein, Associate Director of Research at the Center of Japanese Economy and Business, part of the Columbia Business School, and with Greg Ipp of The Economist, the author of the little book of economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.